This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about an issue we probably don't discuss enough on this show, and that's animal rights. With me to talk about it is Bruce Friedrich. He's co-author of the Animal Activist's Handbook, Maximizing Our Positive Impact in Today's World. That's the subhead. Bruce Friedrich's also the Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs at PETA. Bruce Friedrich, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hey, thanks so much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on with you.
Oh, no. Tell me a little bit about your background, though.
Well, I became a vegan 21 years ago in college. I was very active with a group called Poverty Action Now. We volunteered at a shelter in Des Moines and also organized fasts for Oxfam International. I was involved in a group called Latin American Support Organization. This was 87, so we were looking at U.S. policy in Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala. And I read a book called Diet for a Small Planet, which convinced me that the inefficiency of cycling grains and corn and other products through animals in order to eat animals, you know, wasn't something that I, as an environmentalist and a human rights activist, should be supporting. Spent about 6 years running a homeless shelter in a soup kitchen.
How'd you get from there to the soup kitchen?
Mitch Snyder came around and told all of us who were activists at Grinnell College in Iowa that we were wasting our lives and that the best among us were going to become cogs in an unjust social order. And if we really cared about global poverty and the poor, we would drop out and join the revolution. So after doing my junior year at the London School of Economics, I did in fact drop out for 6 years to go hang out with Mitch in inner city Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, he committed suicide that summer.
Were you there when he committed suicide?
No, he killed himself in August of 1990, and I arrived in Washington, D.C. in October of 1990.
The group must have been still in shock.
Yeah, I think it probably is still
in shock.
And
what was the cause for that terrible thing? I mean, depression often has a long arc prior to the act, but do you know what the cause was then?
Well, he was, Mitch had was absolutely impossible for him to take a break. You know, everybody was telling him, you need to, go, and he would say, the poor don't ever get a break, and he just refused. You know, it's that sort of fine line that all of us who are trying to be activists need to walk between not letting ourselves off too easily, but also not, flaming up and burning out. And I think, there's a lot of speculation about why he committed suicide. But, from the outside, as somebody who knew him a little bit and knew very well people who got him into activism in the first place, I think it was just his inability to, take it easy every once in a while.
No, there's a lesson there for sure. And what was it like working at the homeless shelter?
It was really a joy. I mean, the shelter was a shelter for families, so we had kids there, and it was interesting to sort of see things from children's perspective. They don't realize they're poor. They don't realize they live in a homeless shelter, and they have an ability to live in the moment. That is another, I think, lesson that a lot of us could take. So I really, really loved my time there, and still go back and volunteer and hang out with the children.
Was it a big jump from did you go directly from the homeless shelter to PETA?
I went back to Grinnell to graduate. When I left, I was
just 3.
Your parents
must have been pleased.
They were delighted. I was 3 credits short of graduation, and so I went back for one semester. Grinnell, to its credit, paid for everything, including my flights, my room and board, everything, because I had no money. I was part of the Catholic worker movement, and part of that movement is voluntary poverty. So my 6 years in the shelter, we weren't paid. Grinnell paid for everything for me to come back. And then I went from graduating in the spring of 1996 to working at People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And a lot of people, PETA is a pretty type A, intense place to work, but it was definitely less intense than running a homeless shelter and a soup kitchen in inner city Washington.
And the move from working with human beings to working and on behalf of human beings to working for animals and on behalf of animals, how'd you take that jump?
Well, I had been a vegan for 6 or 7 years, I guess, and had been talking to people in the faith-based peace community of which I was a part about animal rights issues. You know, I think some of the great peace activists and social justice activists, people like Leo Tolstoy and Mohandas Gandhi and Cesar Chavez, were also animal rights activists. And I see it really as you know, a whole cloth, the idea of nonviolence, as Dick Gregory said, other animals suffer and die just like we suffer and die. Another great civil rights, human rights, and animal rights activist, Dick Gregory.
And so this was a natural thing then for you?
It was. And when PETA hired me, one of the first things that I did was created a talk about nonviolence and animal rights and went around to college campuses giving that talk. Also put the Pax Christi published the sort of text version of the talk in their newsletter, and I was able to sort of immediately begin talking about the idea of nonviolence and compassion as being something that shouldn't be bound by species. It was a pretty natural progression.
I'm speaking with Bruce Friedrich. He is the Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs over at PETA, and he also is the co-author of a new book, a pamphlet kind of book, called The Animal Activist Handbook. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Man, you're a mellow PETA guy. I mean, when I think of PETA, I think of confrontational activism, in-your-face politics, and yet you are so low-key, and maybe that's your personality, but also having read this book, I suspect it's also intentional. And so why are you this way?
Well, I've always been, I mean, I'm very German Lutheran, and German Lutherans, you know, one of the, I guess, things that is good about being German Lutheran and bad about being German Lutheran is that we tend not to lose our tempers. We're not especially in touch with our emotions. It's helpful in a debate format because somebody can be screaming at you and you're not really, don't feel called to scream back. Not as useful as in relationships, although I'm, you know, recovering and getting better and better about it. But I do think that if your goal is to convince somebody to see something from your point of view, it's very useful to be able to step into their shoes and see things from their point of view. And very few of us are convinced by being, you know, pilloried or castigated. We're generally convinced by, you know, having a discussion in which people are able to say, hey, you think this, so maybe you could look at this in this other way.
But doesn't PETA pillory and castigate?
We do in the public sphere in order to get attention. I mean, it's the sad fact of the mainstream media. That's what is interesting to the mainstream media. I mean, naked celebrities, really just celebrities in general, but if you get them naked, it's even more interesting, and controversy and conflict. And so in order to get attention, we'll oftentimes, you know, sort of step into that mold. But when we have people one-on-one, I don't think anybody at PETA, you know, ever one-on-one yells at anybody.
But let's just talk about that confrontational stuff for a second, because is it successful even on the tactical level, you know, throwing blood or red paint on a woman wearing a red coat, fur coat, or whether, let's just take that for an example.
Well, PETA doesn't throw paint on people. I mean, we don't actually assault anyone. You know, if for example, Giselle on the fur fashion show runway, and we sent her videos and we wrote her letters and we didn't hear back, and then PETA activists took over the runway with banners that said Giselle fur scum. Not the tactic we would have used one-on-one with her, but it did allow, you know, we did reach tens of millions of people and had the opportunity to do radio and TV interviews and, you know, reach millions more with the opportunity to talk about the fur industry.
But for the people who didn't hear the interviews but who just saw the act, I mean, you may have reached them in that they saw it or heard it, but were you influencing them in a direction that you wanted to influence them?
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question. We tend to think that if you have the opportunity to generate a discussion and get people thinking about an issue, that's better than silence and not thinking about the issue. So you think about, you know, one organization that we're, you know, up against, McDonald's, which, you know, boils chickens alive. They spent $2 billion on advertising last year. That's many times our entire operating budget. So in order to get people thinking about that issue, we'll sometimes do things like, you know, passing out unhappy meals outside of McDonald's restaurants, and the media thinks that that's interesting. You know, same sort of analysis with Giselle. People either aren't thinking about the fur industry at all, or we do something, you know, controversial and get them thinking about it.
What about this image that was that you guys distributed at PETA called Holocaust on Your Plate a couple years back? This was an image of a famous image of the Holocaust on one side and an image of cruelty to animals on the other. And I just wonder whether that was A, effective, and B, whether this analogy, but direct analogy between animals and humans is one that you want to force like that.
Well, you know, it was the Holocaust on Your Plate was the idea of Isaac Bashevis Singer, who wrote in Enemy's Love Story that in the eyes of the animals, all human beings are Nazis. And he talked about the mindset of the Holocaust, the might makes right moral philosophy, and said that what human beings do to animals, especially in slaughterhouses, is the epitome of that mindset. And he called speciesism the purest form of racism because it so thoroughly elevates this, you know, idea. It's the weakest of the sort of God's creatures, as he put it, and it's human complete subjugation to the point at which we're actually eating their corpses. And the Holocaust on Your Plate was taking that concept and sort of turning it into a display. I can tell you from actually having been there on college campuses where we were passing out leaflets and showing the display that it was extraordinarily effective, and we got a very positive response. Of course, we got a very negative response in sort of the ADL. Abe Hoffman came out very strongly against it, as did the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and we did end up actually, you know, pulling that display in response to their concerns.
How did you respond to them? I mean, I know you pulled it, but what was that conversation like?
Well, you know, the original goal was to say, you know, look at these mindsets. And if you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., it talks about there are books there on various genocides, genocide against Native Americans, genocide in Cambodia, genocide, obviously, you know, the epitome of genocide in Nazi Germany. And so it was, you know, looking at that and saying, let's break down the species barrier and look at this other idea that Isaac Bashevis Singer had put out. So we tried to have that conversation, but it was a difficult conversation to have. And rather than making the method the message, we wanted the message to be the message, and that was getting lost.
Speaking with Bruce Friedrich, Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs over at PETA, and this is Progressive Radio. There are these urgent issues of genocide and still with us today and other terrible human crises, global warming, there's AIDS, there's poverty. Half the world lives on under $2 a day. So I'm wondering why focus on animal rights?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that people ask that question is, for me, sort of the answer to the question. Other animals are made of flesh and blood and bone, just like human beings are. They have the same five physiological senses that we do. The foremost Darwin scholar today, Richard Dawkins, he calls other species our cousins and talks about, his words, speciesist arrogance, this ethical idea that human beings are the only species that matter. So I think that other species deserve moral consideration. Tolstoy called vegetarianism the taproot of humanitarianism. Gandhi talked about it as an essential element of nonviolence, holistic nonviolence. And you know, human beings have an awful lot of people fighting for them, and nobody saying, why are you fighting for human beings? The fact that people ask that about animals is really why I'm doing it.
Is it? Would you put them on the same plane, though? Fighting for humans is the same as fighting for animals and vice versa?
I think it's all about nonviolence. I mean, as a human being, I have a bias for human beings, but it is, I think, all about nonviolence. It's all about trying to create this more just and compassionate world and society. And if we can have compassion for animals, we will certainly also, one hopes, have compassion for human beings. I mean, as I mentioned, my original reason for getting involved was a simple recognition that with, you know, the most recent statistic is 1.4 billion people living in dire poverty, 987 million people living in what the UN calls nutritional deficit. And even as we're doing this, we're taking 760 million metric tons of grain and corn, as well as most of the 225 million metric tons of soy, and we're feeding that stuff to chickens and pigs and other farmed animals. It drives the price of food up, and it actually causes people to starve.
What about people who eat free-range chicken or grass-fed cows or organic meat. They like the taste of meat, and they are cognizant that there is some ethical problem involved in the act, and so they're trying to minimize that by going that route. What do you say to those people?
Well, I mean, obviously, that's a move in the right direction. Factory farming takes these animals and basically turns them into widgets, and there are some farmers who are doing things that are less ethically compromised. But, I mean, for me, a basic issue of integrity is that we try not to pay other people to do things that we wouldn't do personally. You know, the vast majority of people wouldn't slit animals' throats open. Most people don't even want to see animals having their throats slit open. They don't even want to think about it. So, you know, all of us could take part in every aspect of getting beans and grains and fruits and vegetables to the table, but most of us wouldn't want to take part in, you know, pretty much any aspect of getting meat to the table. Some would, but most of us wouldn't. So I think we should ask ourselves, you know, where's the basic integrity in paying people to do things to animals we wouldn't do personally?
Bruce Friedrich, how far would you take this as far as, for instance, you know, there are, you don't have to kill a cow to get milk and butter or ice cream. Is there an ethical issue involved there?
But they do kill the cows. I mean, even on organic dairies, they might keep cows around for 7 or 8 years out of a natural lifespan of 20 to 25 years. On the factory dairies, they send them to slaughter before they're even 5 years old. It's the veal industry, of course. The male babies of dairy cows are sent off to the veal industry. The female babies are raised to replace their mothers. I mean, there's an awful lot of exploitation involved in the dairy industry, you know, just like the other industries.
So a cow that's milked for 7 years doesn't go out to pasture then?
Well, I mean, you know, you're here in Wisconsin. When it gets cold, the cows will be shut up in a barn for pretty much their, you know, the entire winter. They don't get to really be cows. They don't get to suckle their babies because their babies are taken away from them so that they can be milked so that we can consume the milk that, you know, nature designed for the baby cows. I mean, we don't need the milk of cows any more than we need the milk of, you know, rats or dogs or any other mammal. So, I mean, the challenge for me as a faith-based peace activist, the challenge for me is if I can choose between adding to the level of mercy in the world or adding to the level of misery in the world every single time, I want to choose mercy. You know, compassion or cruelty every single time, I want to choose compassion.
Speaking with Bruce Friedrich, who is the Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs over at PETA, he's the co-author of the Animal Activist Handbook with Matt Ball. Let's talk about the handbook for a little bit. I was struck by a sentence in your preface or in the introduction, I can't remember which, that said, "This is a book about the importance of being happy." I didn't think that was going to be one of the main themes that I was going to get right at the top. What do you mean by that? Why is that the essence of this book?
Well, you know, it goes back to Alice Walker, the title Possessing the Secret of Joy. What you learn in reading this spectacular novel is that the secret of joy is not to become apathetic in the face of injustice. It's to be able to see the injustice in the world and to fight against it. So whatever cause you're going to pick, and, you know, obviously, as the editor of The Progressive, you are fighting against injustice. The principal theme of the book is, first, fight against injustice, and then second, here are some tips on the basis of a lot of errors that Matt and I have been making over the years to do it as effectively as possible.
What are some of those errors?
Well, I think that, you know, the biggest one is the importance of having conversations with people. I mean, it's really revolutionized my activism. I have 12 of this shirt that says, "Ask me why I'm a vegetarian." And I'm constantly having these conversations in coffee houses or airports or airplanes or wherever else. And it used to be somebody would ask me and I would launch into a diatribe that caused the person's eyes to roll into the backs of their heads. And, you know, as soon as I took a breath, they ran away as fast as they possibly could.
And maybe you didn't take a breath for 90 seconds, too.
Yeah, well, that's true, too, as you're catching on. But, you know, now, since 97% of people oppose cruelty to animals, and since eating meat involves paying people to do things to animals that most of us wouldn't do, I try to have a conversation with people about that, ask them what they think of cruelty, ask them if there are other areas in their lives where they're, you know, paying people to do things that they don't even want to think about.
But don't they recoil at being judged?
No, not in my experience. I mean, on my flight over here, I had two conversations with people, and it's not something people have spent a lot of time thinking about. And if you have a conversation that's open and honest, and in which you don't, you know, pretend that you are morally pure, because none of us are, I've found that the conversations can really be have a lot of good give and take, and the person leaves feeling like they're thinking about something they hadn't thought about before.
What are some any other errors that you want to deal with in this animal activist handbook?
Well, we have a lot. We spent an awful lot of years making, you know, doing things more wrong than right, and I'm sure we have a lot of things we're doing wrong now that hopefully people will let us know about. But, you know, for many years I refused to go to our family gatherings in Zumbrota, Minnesota. Well, I'd go to the gatherings, but I'd skip the meals, feeling like I was, you know, sending some strong moral message by not being at the meal, when of course, you know, what the people there were thinking was, gosh, if you're vegan, you can't even, you know, go to something as important as table fellowship. A lot of years, I would oftentimes not really think about the importance of one person and what one person can do to make a difference without a whole lot of effort. You know, so like wearing this Ask Me Why I'm Vegetarian t-shirt, or carrying literature, or having a bumper sticker on the back of my laptop. I was sitting in a coffee shop earlier before this interview, and I have a vegetarian bumper sticker on my laptop, and somebody came up and said, "What's a vegetarian starter kit?" You know, and I gave them one.
What is a starter kit?
It's recipes and information. Anybody who wants one, we've got them free at goveg.com. You can order it, or you can call 888 veg food. It's principally recipes, but it's also information about the health, environmental, and human rights and animal protection reasons to be a vegetarian.
One of the other errors you talk about in the Animal Activist Handbook, Bruce Friedrich, is dressing in a more conventional way, or the error was not dressing in a conventional way.
No, it's true. When I was running the homeless shelter in the soup kitchen, I only owned a few outfits. I didn't own anything that most people would be seen in public in. I looked, depending on who you ask, like either Jesus or Charles Manson. Bathed just a couple times a week, would go a week or more without wearing shoes. And I wasn't any less able to have a conversation about, you know, peace or nonviolence or vegetarianism, but a lot of people were less interested in listening to me. And again, it's about making the message rather than the messenger, the message.
You have a line in this book, by coming across as fanatical, we're turning people away. But don't you think PETA comes across as fanatical? It certainly has the image of coming across as fanatical.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense for our adversaries to try to paint us as fanatical. I mean, most times when I do an interview and somebody calls in, they, you know, one of the big things is, you know, PETA is opposed to that, or PETA is opposed to this, or PETA said this or said that. And more times than not, it's not something we've ever said or done. You know, the vivisection industry, the meat industry, there are an awful lot of people who want to discredit us, and they have a lot more money and a lot larger, you know, megaphone to try to spew things that just aren't true.
Who, which companies are the biggest violators of animal rights?
Well, I would put KFC right at the top of the list. I mean, I'd probably put Tyson and Pilgrim's Pride even higher, but it's harder to boycott Tyson or Pilgrim's Pride since the vast majority of their sales go to grocery stores and fast food outlets. I mean, KFC claims that it wants to make a difference on animal protection, and yet, you know, chickens are the most abused animals on the face of the planet. They literally grow almost seven times as quickly as they did just 50 years ago, so that they can barely walk. Alice Walker calls eating chickens eating misery. Their death rates are 1% per week, and at slaughter, they're all still conscious when their throats are slit open. You know, it's 10 billion animals just in the United States. You know, for every person in the United States, we eat about 30 birds, and their lives and their deaths are really beyond our worst imaginings. So KFC has a lot of power to make changes, and thus far they've refused to do anything.
How many chickens does KFC kill a year?
They kill about a billion chickens per year, which, you know, you compare that to Tyson, it's about 2.2 billion. Pilgrim's Pride is about 2.5 billion. But KFC and McDonald's are the two biggest customers, and KFC is the most hypocritical.
Does PETA enter into discussions with Kentucky Fried Chicken? And if so, what are those conversations like?
Yeah, I mean, we've been in discussions with Kentucky Fried Chicken since 2001 when they first said that they wanted to raise the bar on animal welfare. And Jonathan Bloom, their senior VP for public affairs, told me personally that animal welfare was a very big deal for them. They hired 4 of the 5 people who we asked them to hire to advise them, meat industry consultants, and all of those people resigned in disgust within a couple of years, saying, you know, one of them told the Chicago Tribune she felt like she was being used. Another one said that upper management just didn't care about animal welfare. I mean, these are people who design slaughter systems. They're not even animal rights activists or animal welfare activists. And yet they were just, you know, they felt that KFC just didn't care about the issue.
I mean, is there a way that they could when they're killing a billion chickens a year anyhow? I suppose they could kill them less cruelly, but you're still killing a billion. You're killing a billion birds a year. That's a lot.
Well, it is a lot, but because they have sort of such a large shopping cart, they could certainly do, they could make tremendous strides. I mean, you take one animal welfare improvement, multiply it by a billion animals, and that's a lot of alleviated suffering. KFC in Canada actually agreed to do everything that we were asking them to do, and we're not campaigning against them in Canada. They also, really give us a bonus, they're now offering a vegan faux chicken in all of their Canadian outlets.
Have you had that?
I have, yeah. My wife is from Windsor, so
taste like?
We were hoping that they would use this Gardein protein product, and they didn't. It's a patty. I guess it's just easier for them to have it across all of their systems. But it's pretty good. I mean, it's like a chicken burger, basically, and it's really quite tasty. We'd love to see that implemented in the United States. But, I mean, in the United States, the stuff we're asking for and that is recommended by, you know, meat industry consultants is not watershed stuff. It's, you know, stop breeding them so that they can't even walk. It's implement a new slaughter system that doesn't involve, you know, slitting their throats open while they're still completely conscious. We'd love to see a vegan chicken, but we'd stop campaigning against them if they just took their own pronouncements seriously.
I'm speaking with Bruce Friedrich. He's the Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs over at PETA. He's the co-author of the Animal Activist Handbook with Matt Ball. We only have about a minute left. What I liked about this handbook was you're stressing the importance of leading a purpose-driven life, not only because it's the right thing to do, but because if you lead a purpose-driven life, you're suggesting that people will be happier. And how does that equation work?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of ennui and apathy and people feeling disempowered. And, you know, it goes back to, again, Possessing the Secret of Joy. I just love that novel and love the title of that novel. The idea that in the face of so much injustice and suffering, and all of us have to feel weighted down by even just the statistics or, you know, looking at things that our government and other governments are doing. And once you start engaging meaningfully and trying to change that, it allows you to feel empowered rather than disempowered. It for me at least, it brings joy to my life. And I've talked to an awful lot of other advocates in a range of issues who feel the same way.
How do you avoid burnout that afflicts so many activists? You talked about it earlier.
Well, I mean, yeah, we talk a lot about avoiding burnout. And I mean, it has to do, I think, with giving yourself a break now and then, recognizing that actions matter, words don't matter, not taking offense so easily when you, you know, get into conversations with people who disagree with you. There are a range of things that we can do. And I think that top of the list is have a sense of humor and don't take yourself or your cause too seriously.
Well, I can say amen to both of those things. Bruce Friedrich, thanks so much for being my guest today.
My pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.